Yes, I understand that every life must end. As we sit alone, I know someday we must go.
Oh, I'm a lucky man to count on both hands the ones I love.
Some folks just have one, you know, others they've got none. Oh. Stay with me, oh, let's just breathe.
This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and it's time for our regular final thought segment. That's Willie Nelson's Just Breathe, and that's what we'll be using each and every time we do this segment. It's such a beautiful song. And in this segment, we hear final thoughts from people who are dying, and also final thoughts from folks about their loved ones, a eulogy, a written tribute, anything that stirs the souls. This week's final thoughts feature is a powerful one from Herb London, a former professor and dean at NYU, and the former president of the Hudson Institute. He's presently the president of the London Center for Policy Research and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. Herb read for us his written tribute to his dad, Yonkel London, more familiarly known as Jack. The tribute is from Herb's book, The Overheated Decade, and was later republished in the Washington Post. Let's tune in to the first portion.
He was lying in a coma at St. Vincent's Hospital in New York City. The doctor said he was dying from a cerebral hemorrhage. I knew better. He was dying of obsolescence, of unfulfilled dreams, trapped in an age he no longer understood. He had been a survivor of the Depression, the product of an era when whatever you got, you earned. Little you had made no difference because everyone had little. You worked hard because that was the only way to get a little more. Nobody knew from trust funds. You learned about cleanliness by walking on the newspaper spread over your mother's freshly washed floor. When you got a present of any kind, even a spool without thread, you played with it for 2 weeks, kept it in your box of valuable possessions, along with bottle tops and baseball cards, and if your father consented, put it under your pillow before dreams about the gas house gang filled your thoughts. Loyalty to wife and family, appreciation for what you had, kindness, respect, cheerfulness, hard work, often beyond the requirements of the job, these were what counted. It was in the mid-1960s that the nightmare started. Suddenly, because you worked hard, you were called a slave. Because you were polite, you were obsequious. Even devotion to wife and children was not a virtue anymore. Some screaming woman claimed your devotion was subjugation. Cleanliness had magically become a false value. The dirty jeans you called shamatas or rags were worn as a uniform. Curse words you deplored were used even by your children's teachers. Because you wouldn't let your 18-year-old daughter have sex in her bedroom, you were called a hypocrite. Because you were nurtured on work and opposed welfare, you were a racist. What had happened to the world?
And already you're getting a real palpable sense for Herb's dad, who he was, and the times in which he lived and grew up. Let's continue with how Yonkel's voracious work ethic began at an early age.
By the time he was a teenager, Yonkel, or Jack, as some called him, had already had 4 jobs. He never knew his father, who was no good anyway, so he was forced to work to help his mother survive and to assist his older brother, Izzy, who was going to law school. At the height of the Depression, he got a job at a bookstore on 4th Avenue in Manhattan. The owner was so impressed with his diligence that he rewarded him with buying and selling responsibilities, in addition to dusting thousands of books. More responsibility didn't mean more money. After all, he had to be happy to have a job at all. When the owner was arrested and sent to Sing Sing for stealing a rare book, Yonkel ran the store by himself for 5 years, never taking an extra penny and traveling to the prison on his day off to present his employer with a complete ledger of sales and purchases. His additional compensation was the right to borrow several Dickens novels and a few books on psychology. They were always returned without a mark so that a future sale was possible. When his mother moved the family from Bayonne, New Jersey to Williamsburg section of Brooklyn, Yonkel walked 2 miles a day so that he could attend Boys High, then the center of adolescent Jewish intellectuals. His dream was to go to college, but as his mother always said, "Yonkel, we must help Izzy get through school first." So Yonkel educated himself in the bookstore, and every penny he earned went into the house. His only pleasure came from being on the track team for one semester and eating Charlotte Russe's on Delancey Street.
And we're getting a real picture now of Yonkel's life. And now we need to turn to the romantic part of his life and how he met his wife during the height of the Great Depression.
He was good looking, but he didn't go out very often. Who had time for girls? One evening on the Avenue U platform of the BMT subway, he met a girl with exquisite legs who paid him as much attention as the models on the billboards. But he wouldn't take no for an answer. After months of pursuit, mostly with romantic correspondence, he married the girl in a simple ceremony. He had no money, and she had even less. To make matters worse, he lost his job 2 days after the wedding. Still, they picked up and went on a honeymoon to Lakewood, New Jersey for the weekend. They were 21 and 20, in the middle of a depression, unemployed, without an apartment of their own, but with pride and faith in one another.
And when we come back, we're going to hear more from Herb London, his eulogy to his father, Yonkel. And this is Our American Stories, our final thought segment. More after these messages. American Stories. It's our final thought segment. And let's pick up where we left off. Herb London on his father, Yonkel. The last clip ended with these two young kids getting married at the height of the Depression and Yonkel losing his job 2 days after their wedding. But Herb said they did have something, and that was pride and faith in one another. Faith that paid dividends, faith that they desperately need.
The first job that became available with the help of friends was at a dry goods store selling sweaters. The owner, a man named Zuckerman, had all the charm of Simon Legree and Scrooge combined, except that he was less generous. But Yonkel was good at selling and knew it. The customers began to say, "Let Yonkel serve me," yet Yonkel went nowhere. When he mustered enough courage to ask for a raise, Zuckerman replied, "You want a raise? I'll lift you off the chair." World War II made some decisions for Yonkel. Since he had a newborn child by then, he was given the choice of an Anzio beachhead or the Wright Aeronautical Company, so he spent the war making propellers for B-24s. Each morning at 5 a.m., he would kiss his wife on the forehead, flex the arms that held his colicky child all night, and took off for the swamps of New Jersey. There was never any complaining. He did his part, and he didn't expect any medals. Being free from the fumes of Secaucus would be sufficient reward. During the war, Jack had taken a part-time job with a firm marketing plastic material that resembled leather, if your eyesight was 400 by 400, to pay the rent on the two-room apartment they had moved to in Brighton Beach. In 1945, when he left Wright, he continued to work full-time at the fake leather company. It wasn't much of a job, but it wasn't Zuckerman either. Actually, he didn't have much of a choice. He wasn't eligible for the GI Bill to complete the BA degree that had begun at Brooklyn and then City College. He had no experience that could be turned into a higher-paying job, and he had a family to support. The fake leather company was a family firm where the brothers sat on their hands and provided sinecures for their children who sat on their hands. But Jack didn't care who did the work and who got the rewards. He loved his work. After years of lifting plastic rolls and taking orders, he was promoted to salesman. He saw it as an extraordinary event. On your own to sell a product and yourself. Before long, his customers were less concerned with his product and more concerned with him. Jack, what do you say? How's your bright son? Is your wife feeling okay? He would reply in Yiddish or Italian or Russian, depending on his customer's language of choice. He knew about their kids, their financial problems, their girlfriends on the side. His dedication to his work was never equivocal. Yankel, I've never seen anyone so devoted to a business. You must be one of the family. But not only wasn't he in the family, he never received a commission or inflated his expenses. He was probably the only salesman in the country who worked without commission and didn't think it was necessary. They're not bad fellows. I'm sure they'll do okay by me, he would say on the rare occasion when his wife would ask about his salary. The years slipped away for him. There were improvements in his life, but by any dispassionate measure, he was falling way behind.
And next, Jack and his family would find a better place to live, and Jack would find something every working man needs, a hobby.
He moved from the two-room flat to an apartment in Queens. Now that his son was 12, it was somewhat more difficult for husband, wife, and child to sleep in the same bedroom. The place in Kew Gardens Hills wasn't really much, but the cockroaches hadn't yet invaded. His son wasn't rolled for dimes on his way to school, and the subway ride to Manhattan was somewhat shorter. The rent of $99 a month was three times what he had paid before, but his wife and son rarely made financial demands. They believed, as did Jack, that Queens was the promised land. To help him get to new customers on Long Island, Jack asked for and received a loan to buy a car. For him, it wasn't an ordinary automobile desired for its function. It was superordinated into the realization of a fantasy. He had his own car. It was a special possession which required cleaning three times a day. When Jack wasn't working or attending to family responsibilities, he was, as his wife would say, pitching the car. As a kid, he had hardly any toys. The one toy gun and holster he got as a Hanukkah present, he kept in perfect working order until he was 17. His suits and jackets were lined up like toy soldiers in his closet, and each shirt in his dresser was separated from the others by tissue paper to avoid any possibility of creasing. But the car was his prize. When passers-by would see it, they would always ask how he got that shine. The answer was simple. He Simonized his car every single day. When he saw young people deal capriciously with possessions, he would say, they have too much. They just don't know how much sweat went into getting it.
They have too much. I could hear my grandparents saying that from the grave still. Let's continue with Herb London's recounting of his father Yankel, a.k.a. Jack's life.
His son became something of a basketball jock, yet he responded with the same equanimity to his son's success as his own anonymity. Sure, he was proud, but it was more important not to let high school fame go to his son's head. Whether the boy performed well or didn't, he always had a good thing to say. So you didn't score 20 points tonight. There will be other games and other opportunities. It was wisdom he could apply to others, but not to himself. When opportunity called, as it often did, he was reluctant to act. How can I take a chance? After all, the company has a pension and profit-sharing plan for me. I'm not doing so badly.
Did you hear that? Yankel put his family's future above his own dreams and ambitions. And folks, that happens every day here in American life. We so often celebrate the entrepreneur on this show, and we do and should, but it can be just as challenging, maybe even more so, to not pursue one's dreams for the sake of the family, to not take that risk, because you have bigger and more personal responsibilities to attend to. As Yankel said, I'm not doing so badly. Well, does his son Herb think he was right?
His judgment, though, is illusory. Living at the economic margin, he could not escape the encroachment of ghetto conditions. His garden apartment in the promised land became overrun with the ubiquitous flies around the garbage cans, rumors of robbery, scratches on his prized car, and neighbors who had no pride in their own appearance, much less the appearance of their residences. He tried to escape, but he couldn't keep pace with inflation and the sprawl of urban problems. Where can you go when you haven't gotten a raise in 3 years and inflation is at 10% a year? He moved to the Left Rack City apartment complex and for the first time in years was genuinely happy about his home, even though his son, who was teaching at the time, had to contribute part of his salary so that the rent could get paid. The place was clean, his neighbors pleasant, and there are always people around to talk about everything from the merits of turtle wax to national politics. But this condition was also ephemeral. With the number of welfare recipients spiraling at a mind-boggling rate during the Lindsay years, and with apartment space at a premium, it was only a matter of time before the city administration would subsidize welfare families at Left Rack City. With that decision, Jack's world crumbled again, as did his faith in liberal politics. It wasn't that he was a racist, but when the newcomers came in large numbers, so did crime, chicken bones in the stairwells, crude language, and graffiti on the walls. But that wasn't the worst of it. Welfare recipients next door lived in an apartment larger than his, received rent subsidies, food stamps, and free medical care, paid no taxes, received a regular dole, and if his New York Times was accurate, had an annual income based on total aid of $11,500. Jack paid his rent properly, rarely ate out because he couldn't afford it, didn't qualify for free emergency care in a public hospital because he lived in a one-bedroom apartment, paid his taxes, and earned an annual salary of $11,000 with a take-home pay of $159 a week. Moreover, he didn't demonstrate, was always polite, clean, and courteous. Yet no one gave a damn about him. Not the Lindsays, not even the Beams. He voted ritualistically, if not enthusiastically, for Democratic candidates. But in his gut, he knew no one represented his situation.
The forgotten man, in the end, Herb London, letting us all remember. Yankel London. This is our Final Thoughts series. When we come back, the end of this great and stirring eulogy. Son to father, after these messages. This is Our American Stories, and it's time for the final part of this stirring eulogy, Herb London, to his father, Yankel. And this is a part of our Final Thought series. Love, death, life itself, every aspect of it, we cover it here on Our American Stories. And this, we think, is the most important part, actually. A eulogy may be the most important piece of writing you ever do in your life. And my goodness, I can bet you anything that Herb would agree with that. In the last segment, we heard about how government welfare devalued Yankel's life and his relentless labor while giving nicer apartments in his building to those who didn't work at all. Yanka would become weary about the government who was supposed to represent him too, Herb tells us.
And he became more and more reactionary and jaundiced about all politicians. As far as he was concerned, his hard-earned tax dollars were being squandered on foreign wars with no apparent purpose, on people who returned the favor with insults, and on corporations who were already corpulent beyond his comprehension. He couldn't understand the new attitude toward the work ethic, which he called institutional laziness. He watched postal employees work at so slow a pace it defied biology. He and four others like him could make the system efficient in a week. He couldn't understand why it took two construction workers to carry a 2x4, or why university professors didn't work more than 12 hours a week. If he had a job to do, even if it were as insignificant as cleaning a closet, he did it with more zest than the entire Berkeley population could muster for a sit-in at the Bank of America. Despite his emotionally conservative views, he was hardly an Archie Bunker. Yet he was the serious side of Bunker that few give serious attention to. Long before it was fashionable, he recognized the corrosive influence of welfare. Even if he were in an iron lung, welfare of any kind would be inconceivable. He had too much pride to take anything from anyone without a service rendered.
And despite him receiving no help or representation, Jack did not hesitate in helping others or being there for others.
Yet there was a soft side to his hard-nosed values. Irving, of course I'll ask my son how Howie can get into NYU. Sylvia, you can borrow my vacuum cleaner for a month for as long as you like. He walked around Left Rack City like the town crier. He knew every neighbor's name and the first name of every kid in the family. He helped to push cars out of snowdrifts and carry grocery packages for old women. Everyone knew Jack. Since he had come from a broken home, he devoted himself to his family with an unparalleled passion. Because his wife was often ill, he did all of the shopping, cleaning, and dishwashing. He was certainly not sympathetic to the feminist movement. He was simply in love with his wife. After 38 years of marriage, with divorce rates increasing and those staying married cursing at one another unmercifully, Jack actually loved his wife. When his son told him that he had separated from his own wife, Jack cried. He couldn't understand it. Why are you separating? Do you hate her? No, if not, why? When his son suggested that he go away for his 2-week vacation, he replied, why should you go away? I'll walk on the Long Beach, hold hands, and sit on the boardwalk. When he wasn't doing things for his wife and son, he was busy trying to keep his grandchildren happy. Pom Pom, their name for him. Be a horsey. Pom Pom, would you please get us chocolate ice cream? He never refused. When the temperatures were cold enough to hang icicles on his mustache, he went out for chocolate ice cream with sprinkles. Yankel, where are you going on a night like this? His friends would ask. My grandchildren are here.
And we now go to the final portion of Herb London's tribute to his father, Jack, and this again for our final thought series.
Last August, he celebrated his 60th birthday. It was eventful only because he talked about the possibility of retiring. I'll get my pension funds and profit-sharing money and go to Florida. From August through November, he beseeched his employers for the money. Yanko, they would say, it's coming. But I've waited 32 years for a little something. If I have to wait any longer, I won't live to enjoy it. He was almost right. At the end of the year, the company called a meeting to dissolve the employee fund. Jack anticipated a sizable check. He had high hopes, even though for years he had received nothing but empty promises. That morning he told his wife, "This is the day," and it was. At the meeting, the split was announced. For undisclosed reasons, the kind of check Jack had come to believe would be his was not. Moreover, another employee who had been with the firm only a year longer was to receive $8,000 more from the plan, again for unexplained reasons. Jack left the meeting pale. Several minutes later, one of his fellow employees asked, "Jack, why are you dragging your leg?" He didn't know what was happening. An hour later, he lost all feeling on his side. When his son went with him to the hospital, he said two things. don't tell mom about this, and straighten my tie before I go into the hospital. People like Jack don't die easily. They can't cope with the times, but they go down fighting. Their standards are the only shield they have against the onslaught of existential happiness at any price. I knew he was dying, lying in that coma at St. Vincent's, but I just wanted him to wake one more time so I could tell him I loved him. He was my father, and his kind won't be seen anymore. Herb London.
And thank you, Herb, for that. And for anybody listening, just grab a tissue or something. It's just beautiful. And, you know, he'd said something interesting when he dug into that Archie Bunker stereotype. You know, Norman Lear was up to something pretty remarkable in making that show, but he was also doing something pretty nasty. Anybody who thought certain way about the state of welfare was pigeonholed into some kind of Archie Bunker racist. And one thing we know about Herb London and his dad, particularly liberal Jews of that generation, anything from the truth. And Norman Lear knows better. And it was a nasty thing for him to do with all in the family and with that character. And he knew exactly what he was doing. And that still exists today, that sort of thought police, to put into some character who holds an opinion different than yours, some ugly motivation, some level of stupidity. And my goodness, we learn from Herb London the unfairness of what he saw. And actually, in the end, the waste, and the sadness of it all. What a life, what a job. And this is Our American Stories, and that's our final thought segment. And we'd love to hear your final thought stories. Give us a call at 844-627-8255 and record your story there, or leave us your information if you're not comfortable doing that, and we can help you record it. Once again, that's 844-627-8255. If you've written a eulogy, if you've come across a good eulogy, share it with us. I think there's no better way to share an American life than through that kind of storytelling. It's both sad, but it's also beautiful. And my goodness, I think I've learned a little bit about myself listening to that piece. And I hear my grandfather, and I hear that entire generation of Depression-era folks who did so much with so little. And we do so often in this generation, so little with so much. This is Our American Stories. And go to OurAmericanNetwork.org and listen to Tony Dolan's eulogy about his father, Joe. Tony was the chief speechwriter for Ronald Reagan for 8 years, and he wrote some of the most memorable speeches we've all ever heard. But this was his most memorable piece of writing, the eulogy to his father, Joe. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And we regularly like to go to the Wall Street Journal, and sometimes for their opinion writers, but sometimes, well, The Burning Question is one of our favorites. And you've heard Heidi Mitchell before talk about many interesting things. And today, I think maybe one of the most interesting of all of the subjects. And this burning question this week is, does having a baby really make it harder to concentrate? And Heidi, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And by the way, we were just in a conversation just offline, and it was like, look, I know I wrote about something, and hold on a second, and there it is. I almost said, there's the column right there. Heidi, you are having a hard time concentrating because you have three kids. You've got two away in camp and one away in another camp. And talk about your personal experience of this burning question before we get into the actual science of this, Heidi.
Well, I think, you know, it's a sort of misconception that is something called mommy brain, right? It's like this fogginess that you feel like you're being pulled in so many directions when you, it's not just when you have babies, though, it's when you have kids in general, and fathers feel it too, right? You're, you know, it's hard to focus on work when something important is going on with your kid, and I think we all feel that way. But your brain's super adaptive, and we've evolved for many generations, and so have other animals. And there's lots of evidence out there that say that maybe not definitively prove, but lots of evidence to show that maybe having your kids doesn't make it harder to concentrate. Maybe it just feels that way, but it makes you better at some things.
Yeah, you know, I once heard, it was a unique little autobiography, Judge Ginsburg was being interviewed, and she talked about having a child while she was in her first year at Harvard. Her husband then moved to Columbia. She went with him, and she talked about the fact that having a child actually focused her more. She had to get home and take care of the child, so she had this tremendous focus in her study time because she wanted to get to that child. And she also said that, in a sense, it made her an adult, and it took her away from the worries of the traditional law student. And it was fascinating to hear that from someone like Judge Ginsburg, who, by the way, when she was at Columbia, was one of just several women in the entire class, Heidi.
The notorious RBJ.
And that's
RBG.
Right, the notorious RBG. That's right. So tell me this, Heidi. What are the earliest changes to a woman's brain even before the baby is born?
So, yeah, so it's important to think about the idea of becoming a parent. And this also affects men, too, and we can talk about that later. But, you know, you start to become a parent biologically and neurologically well before the child comes out of you. So I like to refer to it as a fetus. But as this fetus is growing inside of you, your brain structure is increasing. So it's sort of like the lattice work that holds it up is getting stronger and bigger. And certain parts of the brain show that, including the part of the brain that focuses on executive function, which is like making decisions and focus and, you know, making good choices. And they see evidence of this, you know, 3 or 4 months after birth. So it's happening, you know, not until, you know, the fetus is a few months old, but you know, there's different hormones that are going on through your body. Of course, there's things growing inside of you, and your brain is adapting to all that, is getting ready to not take care of just itself, but also to this other thing that's going to come out of you.
And, you know, there's a talk in the column about the higher function of the brain when a mom is pregnant and has multiple pregnancies. You also talk about how moms are anxious and under pressure simultaneously. And how does that change their brains?
So, you know, when your new mothers tend to be super anxious because, you know, you're not used to taking care of yourself and this other thing, right? You have no idea what you're doing.
Right.
And you're always worried about your baby's health. So that is that idea of mommy brain could be that you're distracted because, you know, you feel like your brain doesn't have enough capacity to both think about all your child's needs and take care of your child's needs and take care of all of your own needs. But as the notorious RBG has shown, you know, you want to get all your work done really well the first time so that you can leave at 6 o'clock and get home to nurse your baby or whatever it is. So that anxiety should diminish as you realize, oh, I can do this, you know. And then there's been some evidence, there haven't been studies done on humans, but animal research has shown that multiple pregnancies can maybe even increase that ability to kind of juggle that idea. So not the fog, let's ignore that, but this idea of juggling and being able to do lots of things. I think it was rodents showed that after multiple pregnancies that they had a better time remembering where they hid their food, and that is the main thing they need to do for their baby. Is to remember where to find the food, source the food, and store it somewhere where no one's going to find it.
Yep.
And they have shown that they increased pregnancies has increased capacity for memory. So if we can extrapolate from that, then, well, maybe we're even smarter after we've had a baby.
Well, I think I am, and that's what I want to segue over to the men. Let's take a listen first, Heidi, to Louis C.K. talking about life with a baby.
She woke me up all night. Just woke me up every 10 minutes. Just woke me up. Just said, "Dad," with nothing. That's the worst part. "Daddy! Whoa, what is it?" "You got nothing." So now it's the next morning. I'm making breakfast and I'm gone. I'm insane. I drank too much coffee to overcompensate. And I'm like, I keep having these moments where it's like, and there's nothing there. Just nothing. Okay.
So that could be daddy brain. Is daddy anxious too? Talk about daddy brain.
So the brain activity that's been studied, it shows that it's less in new fathers than in new mothers, but it is still affected, especially the part of the brain that's the parental instinct. So this idea of him being like, "What?" waking up and just hearing the baby go say anything. I mean, that's for real. Dad, there's chemical changes in the dad brains that they are responding to being a parent, this new role. And the brain is creating these new connections all the time and getting smarter, getting better, recognizing, you know how I say that you can tell, oh, that cry means she's hungry and that cry means she's got a wet diaper. And like, you start to kind of learn that, but that's not something you knew 6 months before, right? So your brain's really adaptive. And also they show that men and women have an increase of oxytocin, which is, you know, a love hormone. So men have a little bit less. Women have more, especially if they breastfeed, but it's this kind of feel-good hormone. So, you know, even though you're anxious and you're stressed out and you're juggling, you may have a little bit of euphoria because you're so in love with this new thing that you've created. And so I think the positives seem to outweigh the negatives in most senses. And I always say, if I'm hiring somebody, oh my God, I'm probably not allowed to say this out loud, but a new parent may not be such a bad person to hire.
No.
They're probably like, really want to get home and want to get the work done right. They don't want to lose their job. And so, you know, all of the stakes are much higher now. And so, you know, they might be a really good employee.
You bet. And I don't, you know what I think they don't want to do? I don't think they want to waste time, Heidi. And if there's anything in an office that messes up everything, it's people who waste time because they've got no life. And so they ruin yours.
Right. The other thing is, you know, you might feel more confident after you, like, I always felt like, in fact, I went back to work early. I didn't take the full maternity leave with my first kid because I just couldn't be alone with this kid anymore. Bless his heart. But I just needed to be around grownups. And work was something I totally understood. Like, I got it. I get this. You people are sane. You respond in an adult-like manner to requests. And then you go home to like this chaos of, I don't know what you mean. And like the laundry is not done and the breakfast is still out and all that stuff. But your brain is so adaptive. It's like plastic and it just changes and grows. And you can be better at work. You can be less chit-chatty, or you can like know how to move through that water cooler conversation really fast. You can get back to the job so you can get in that car, commute back home.
You bet. You know, Heidi, are these mommy and daddy brain changes temporary, or is there something more lasting going on here?
It's actually pretty lasting. I mean, that the anxiety tends to go away as you get used to, you know, you get more confident, but the structure of the brain, it's like scaffolding, and it's kind of growing, and it means maybe not permanent because it can go away if you have some sort of head injury or drugs or something else like that. But once you make these connections, we're always talking about the brain's connections. Once you make them, they're there. And so it becomes, the pathway is just much faster. So where it used to take you, you know, a minute or 30 seconds to make a decision about something, it now takes you 3 seconds because you've done it 100 times before. And so that's like a permanent, you know, rapid fire response. Those executive functions, those quick decisions, emotional responses, those things they're just quicker. So yeah, permanent, semi-permanent, pretty permanent.
Well, that's all good news for all of you who have kids and are wondering about whether having a baby really makes it harder to concentrate? I think there's an answer there, I think. Kinda, sorta, in a good way. Heidi, thanks so much for joining us, as always.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. Does having a baby really make it harder to concentrate? And it's our burning question with columnist Heidi Mitchell of the Wall Street Journal. Go to OurAmericanNetwork.org to see all of our work together. More after these messages. Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and now it's time for our Bring Small Businesses Back series, brought to us by the Job Creators Network. And today, we're talking to Heidi Gunal, founder and CEO of Camp Bow Wow, the largest pet care franchise center in North America. With about $90 million a year in business and more than 200 franchises in 40 states and Canada. Heidi, thanks for joining us. We interview a lot of job creators, and we like to start always at the beginning. Tell us about your childhood, where you were from, what the area was like, and a bit about your parents.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Southern California in Orange County, back when Irvine, California was just getting off and started. And my dad was a police officer there, and my mom worked for the rec center there, just in administration. And I have a brother who's 7 years younger, and at age 13, they moved us to Monument, Colorado, a little itty-bitty town by the Air Force Academy, with about 3,000 people. And I think I cried for about a year. I was pretty upset about that move.
Yep.
But it ended up being a great thing.
And what led to that move? What did your dad do? Obviously your dad was in law enforcement, but what precipitated that move? And then talk about your first, if you could, your first bout with somebody who either taught you something about this idea called business ownership, or what your first experience was that led you to the idea that you might want to be in business for yourself.
Well, the two actually tie together. My dad was always very entrepreneurial, and on the side, he'd be doing a lot of things. He always had like a sales job on the side or was promoting a product. And so he moved us to Colorado to take a job in advertising sales. And they just wanted to get us out of Southern California. I think my dad saw the writing on the wall with what was going on as a police officer and thought it'd be better for us to live in a smaller town and in a more rural area. So we moved here, and my dad ended up doing advertising sales, but eventually started his own business and had a couple different businesses and really kind of lit the fire in me around entrepreneurship, I think.
Well, that's great. And that happens sometimes and sometimes not. You know, we've learned from some that, you know, we learned from Mark Cuban that how he learned to get into business for himself is he wanted some money for sneakers, and his dad threw him a case of garbage bags and said, sell these door to door.
And, oh, my gosh, I didn't know that. That's fantastic.
And that was it. And from then, he caught the bug. He thought, my goodness, I can make my own way. So as a kid, we ask every single guest this because we do it for First Jobs Friday, which is a segment we do every Friday. What was your first job? What did you learn from it? And do you have your kids working as early as possible?
Well, my first job was in Monument at working at the Dairy Queen, and I had to perfect the little twirl on the top of the cone.
Oh, that's tough.
It was tough, and they were pretty critical about it. So I got taught to take constructive criticism, but actually I learned a lot about responsibility and showing up on time and keeping to your word, doing what you said you were going to do, and I moved up pretty quickly because of that, and that was honestly a little bit of a preview into my future working at a franchise and understanding just how the general operation worked. I think I started that job when I was 15, and, you know, I really... I really enjoyed it because a lot of my friends worked there, but I also learned a lot about being responsible and in doing what you needed to do to earn a living.
Yeah, we also point out that Gwen Stefani had her first bout of labor at and her first gig at a Dairy Queen. So you're in legendary company.
I like Heidi. That company. I'll take it.
And by the way, for my money, the hamburger at Dairy Queen is just fantastic, and the Dairy Queen milkshake is just a joy. And
yeah,
so I just want to let you know,
awesome.
I'm a big time dairy. As you'll learn, we love every kind of what they call junk food in other places. We call joyful food here on Our American Stories. So
I love that.
Funny story from your first job. Worst experience, best experience. What did you learn about customer interaction in that first job?
The thing I remember the most was when the big buses would pull in off the highway because we were right off I-25 and just, you know, 40 people would come barreling in hungry and grumpy, and there would be three high school kids having to make all this food and serve them, and it was usually a disaster. We usually did not do a good job of handling those big crowds, but you really had to learn to just be humble and apologize a lot and do your best and see if you couldn't work through it.
Yeah, and just push it out and get through it and wait for the next explosion to happen, I guess.
Yes, absolutely. And I remember one of our favorite stories was when the Greg Kinn Band, do you remember them?
Oh, sure.
They came in and they brought their whole like tour bus in, and we were so starstruck. I don't even think we moved for like 30 seconds. We just stood at the register like, oh, what do we do now?
They don't write them like that anymore, Greg Kinn Band.
Yeah,
no, I don't get me on music trivia. We'll go toe to toe for an hour and we'll forget what we were talking about, Heidi. So let me tell you, let me ask you this, the education. We love to ask people where, you know, what they studied, or what connection it had to what they were doing, and where did you do most of your learning, formal learning or the school, as we like to call, the school of hard knocks?
I think I did a lot of the school of hard knocks, but I grew up in a family where my parents didn't go to college. They had us very young at 18 and 20, but they encouraged us to do all we could in the education space and go as far as we possibly could. They really recognized the value of education. So I went to SMU for my first year in Dallas on a scholarship, and then was very homesick, so moved back to Colorado, graduated from CU Boulder, and then ended up getting my master's in healthcare administration from the University of Denver. But I'm always learning. I'm always taking classes and reading and listening to podcasts. And I love to learn new ideas and listening to TED Talks. That's just kind of how I roll.
Well, that's great. And that's I think everyone now knows that education is not static, that you've got to be a lifetime learner. And I think that what's about to happen in the education industry is explosive. And online learning is going to take us in directions and fix problems that we don't even know are fixable.
It goes from my husband being able to, I mean, he's not the handiest guy. He's amazing at a lot of things, but he's the first to get on YouTube to solve any problem known to mankind and teach himself that way. But then you read about like the Khan Academy that's teaching kids calculus that live in Mongolia that would never be exposed to that because they can get online and take a course.
Yep. Hold that thought, Heidi. And when we come back, more from a small business owner, a job creator, an entrepreneur. That's what we do here on Our American Stories. And sometimes, yes, it includes the stories of those people who are out there creating jobs, those people trying to grow their businesses, grow their communities, and ultimately grow the economy. More with Heidi Ganahl after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories, and we're joined again by Heidi Ganahl, founder and CEO of Camp Bow Wow, the largest pet care franchise in North America, with more than 200 franchisees in 40 states and Canada. So you get out of college, and you settle in on pharmaceutical sales. How did that work out for you?
Well, I like liked it. It was a great job, but I called it the golden handcuffs. It was really, it was kind of boring. You did a lot of sample delivery to the doctors and then a lot of catering of lunches, all to get 30 seconds in front of a doctor. So I learned to get my message across really quickly, but it didn't really fill up my soul. It wasn't what I loved doing. And I was married at the time to Brian, my first husband, who was also very entrepreneurial. And we were always thinking up these business ideas. And we had two big fluffy dogs that we couldn't find a place that was good enough to take them. And about that same time, one of the first doggy daycares opened up next to my dad's business, and we fell in love with that concept, so we wrote a business plan for it.
You know, I want to talk about your first husband, just take a detour here. Tell us the story of his tragic end of his life. It had to be a terrible time for you, Heidi, but share that with the audience if you could.
Yeah, Brian was fantastic. He was such a great guy, and he was just one of those people that lit up a room and had such a great soul and spirit to him. But we were together for about 4 years, married for a couple years, and for his 25th birthday, our family, my dad ran into an old family friend who was a United Airlines pilot, and he did air shows with an old 43 Stearman. He was super excited about it, invited my dad to come down to the airport for a ride, and suggested if any of us wanted to go, he'd take us as well. And my dad thought it would be a great thing for Brian to do, and we all agreed. We thought, oh my gosh, he loves doing extreme skiing and all this, you know, very adventurous stuff. So we surprised him with the birthday gift to go up in the plane. And they did all the stunts and did a flyby over my folks. I wasn't there. I had another event going on, and the plane crashed into the ground, and both Cliff and Brian were killed instantly right in front of my folks.
Oh my goodness. And
it was terrible.
And so, we have in our notes, Heidi, that for a while you were just, and I can't imagine how you wouldn't be, but you were lost.
Lost.
So, yeah. And
I was a mess.
You were a mess, but there were these two dogs, Mick and Winnie.
That's right.
They prodded you along, and talk about that, and talk about next steps and you going into this next phase of your life.
Well, the next few years were a mess, and I made some bad decisions with the settlement money I got from the plane crash. I remarried and quickly divorced, but I got a wonderful daughter out of it, Tori, who brought me back to life along with my pups. And about 5 years after the crash, my little brother comes to me, and I'm back in pharmaceutical sales. I'm a single mom now, and he's like, come on, you have so much spirit in you and drive. Let's get the old business plan from Camp Bow Wow and see if we can't get it going. And I was like, really? I'm going to waste. I had $80,000 left from the settlement out of $1 million. And I was like, I don't know that that's the best idea to waste that money on a doggy daycare.
Right.
He's like, I don't want to hear it. We're going to do it. And so we did. And it just took off.
And talk about that first, you know, that first step, you know, because I think that people listening, you just shared something that almost every person thinking about going into business worries about. And that is that so many businesses fail. And my goodness, I heard a statistic about the restaurant business that was overwhelming, like 90% of them fail within 5 years. And I just go, oh, my goodness, that's terrifying. And yet, you know, where would we be without great restaurant entrepreneurs? And they do it and they survive. You started with $1 million. You were down to 83,000. And yet you had to have learned enough from some of those mistakes to carry you through with your first Camp Bow Wow. Because that first one had to be the toughest, right, Heidi?
It was. And I think the lesson I learned from everything I went through before I opened it was, you only live once, and your life is very short, and you have to make the most of it. And, you know, you can't spend your life wondering what if. And so I took a big risk, and I did it. But the difference was I was so passionate about this idea, I just knew it would work. And that's what I tell people. When you have an idea that you're not afraid of, that you don't feel a lot of fear, of course you're going to feel some fear about starting a business, then just roll with it and keep pushing on doors and seeing if they open, and when they don't, move on to the next one. But if there's an idea that you're super passionate about and it just fills up your heart, then roll with it. You've got to at least try it.
Yep. And this was your first space was 2,500 square feet in an old Veterans of Foreign Wars building. It had a drive-up drop-off and a pickup for dogs, but you were the first pet care center in the country with a streaming video feed so people can watch their dogs. My goodness, I got to tell you, that makes, I mean, the little place, there's not a Camp Bow Wow in our little town, but the little place where we have our dogs, it makes my wife so comfortable to know she can watch our dogs.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my brother's brainchild. And the funny thing, video streaming back in 2000 was it would take a picture every 60 seconds and post to the internet.
Right.
And it would be this blur of fur, and you couldn't see any of the dog. But people loved it. And now it's hi-fi video, high-definition streaming, 16, you know, cameras in a camp. You can pull it up on your smartphone. It's very cool.
So now you have the first successful Camp Bow Wow. What leads you to this thing called franchising? And before we even talk about that, just so I can share with the folks who are listening to Our American Stories, franchising is a legal concept and a business concept. And about 1 in 5 businesses in America are franchises. And that's everything from hotels to auto care specialties to maid services, you name it. The industry is 20% of the GDP. But what led you to this space, Heidi?
Well, it wasn't intentional. I had opened my second location, and one of my customers worked for Mrs. Fields Cookies, and he was like, you know, Heidi, I've done a little bit of research, and there is nobody franchising a kennel or a dog daycare. And back then, doggy daycare wasn't anything like it is now. And I thought, all right, I don't know anything about it, but we went to the International Franchise Association conference. I met some great people who agreed to mentor me. We went back to Colorado, put together the legal paperwork, put a sign up on each of the counters, and sold our first franchise within a couple weeks.
Amazing. And, it, you know, it goes to something I think that's important. You, when you're analyzing your own skill sets, what you saw yourself at was more is that more of that person with a vision, more of that person with the marketing skills. But if you would have not gone the franchise route and you would have tried to own and operate each place, you would have had to gotten into the muck and the mire of individual hires, operation and management of all kinds of employees. And people don't know this about a lot of corporate franchisors. They aren't the ones that own these businesses. It's the franchisees that own the decisions. They don't do the marketing, Heidi. But my goodness, they are responsible for the day-to-day business decisions, the hiring, the management. So in a way, this was actually the perfect business structure and legal formation for your particular talents.
It absolutely was. I tell people the franchise model was such a gift to me because I am so visionary and strategic, and you know, I don't enjoy as much being in the day-to-day operations, and I didn't have a lot of capital to grow the brand. But I had a lot of people that wanted to open one of these businesses. Once I got open, they would call me constantly. How do I do this? How do I get one of these places open? This is my dream. I want to hang out with dogs all day and make a living at it. So the beauty of it is you get to help so many other people do what they love and start their own business and make a living doing what, you know, makes them happy.
I think it's what makes franchising so powerful in the end, Heidi. Not enough people can do the marketing. And the branding, but what they can do is run the organization, and they have skin in the game because they're putting up the capital, and they want to return. They want a return on their investment, and you do too. And so it gets incentives lined up in really interesting places. I wanted to talk to you about the National Labor Relations Board, and that's called the NLRB, and they recently handed down what are being called joint employer rulings. Talk about what this means to a small business owner. And obviously, you're not the franchisee. You're the franchisor. But what does this mean to you, the franchisor? And what does it mean to all those individual owners of each Camp Bow Wow around this country? And there are 200 of them.
Well, I'm extremely worried about my franchisees, but also the franchise industry in general. I mean, you go from having very very open-ended operational expertise on the franchisee side. So they get to run their businesses how they best see fit. And, you know, we provide a template for the brand and kind of guide the overall messaging and strategy. But the day-to-day is on the franchisee. And if all of a sudden you've got a franchisor that's liable for all the day-to-day operations of the franchisee and the employment, hiring, and firing decisions, that makes it extremely hard to have the franchise model work the way it does, because the amount of royalties we collect are very, very small in the big picture. Not enough to hire a complete staff of HR folks to manage 3,500 people in the Camp Bow Wow system.
Right.
Whereas at corporate, we typically have, you know, 50 to 60 people on staff.
Yep. And there you have it, folks. You're hearing it plain and simple. These businesses work on thin margins, and they can't afford the compliance costs and all the government regulations. Heidi, hold that thought. When we come back, more from a real-life job creator. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. And now we return to our conversation with Heidi Ganahl, founder and CEO of Camp Bow Wow. What is the NLRB up to, do you think, Heidi, doing this? Why are they doing it? I mean, I can see, I'm a lawyer by training, and I can see that, well, my goodness, it's easier and more fun if you're a trial lawyer to sue the corporate parent than it is the individual store for the negligence of an individual owner. It's spreading the risk up to what I call a deeper pocket. But what else do you think might be the reasons? Because I'm banging up in my head going, these are contracts. You have an actual existing contract between the franchisor and the franchisee, and the NLRB with this ruling would basically be rewriting that contract, Heidi.
That's right. That's right. And you nailed it on the overall intent of it. So I think the trial lawyers are going to love this ruling. But the other thing that's going to happen is franchisors are not going to sell franchise units to the individual mom and pop folks out there. They're only going to work with the big operators that own like 100 Arby's or 100, you know, McDonald's that can handle the capacity of legal work and financial background that's going on behind the scenes. And what I think is going on is I think that the unions are trying to get involved in the restaurant industry and unionize those units because most of the restaurants in the United States are franchises, and that's the way they do it.
Yep, they get in that way. And by the way, who gets hurt the most in this, Heidi, is the franchising is the single greatest way for poor people, minorities, for women to run their own and own their own businesses. And now, because of a ruling like this, goodbye. If you're a big guy, you can survive because you can deal with the compliance. You can deal with fighting off the trial lawyers. But if you're a little guy, no one's going to want to take the risk. The franchisor particularly is not going to take the risk. So
yeah, it breaks my heart. Yeah. I mean, I love small business and entrepreneurship, and I believe that's the key to keeping the American dream alive, keeping the economy going. And they're you're realigning the incentives, and there isn't an incentive for franchisors to sell individual franchises. And the individual folks that buy franchises that have these opportunities to do what they love and make a living at it, the risk is too great then, the expense is too high, and the regulation is too great to make it work.
Yep. And tell us a bit about, before we go to our rapid fire, because we have some fun rapid fire questions for all of our guests, Heidi, and you're not allowed to think too much about them. You just sort of have to answer. But I know she's going, uh-oh, you'll love it. But Job Creators Network, you're a part of this organization. Tell us what it means for you, why you've joined it, and what you're trying to do.
Well, I'm trying to defend small business, and it hurts my heart that there's such an attack going on entrepreneurship and starting small business in America when small businesses employ most people in this country, and it also gives most people the opportunity to start a business, support their family, do what they love, and build wealth and a legacy for their own family over time. And so I've got to put my hand up and say I was blessed to live the American dream, and I was able to start a business doing something totally out of the box that I loved doing and make a living at it and help 200 other franchisees do the same thing. And it's being destroyed right now. So if I don't put my hand up and fight for it, who's going to? And I have four kids that I want to be able to have the same opportunities that I did. So I just feel very passionate about fighting for that American dream.
You know, and Heidi, one of the things we've been doing here on Our American Stories is, you know, the average American listening to this, and we do stories about everything, and we're going to be doing Frank Sinatra's life for an hour after we're done here.
That's awesome.
It's a beautiful story about a man who grows up in Hoboken, New Jersey, looks across that river and sees New York City as some far-off place. And yet he ends up singing New York, New York, and singing it in such an affirmative way that he says, you know, I'm not just that kid from Hoboken. I'm that kid from New York, and I made it there, and I can make it anywhere. And it's such an aspirational notion, what that song is comprised of. It's just spectacular, and it's beautiful, and it's everything that's great about America. We talk about Dodd-Frank, and we've talked about it quite a bit, but how it impacts small bankers. We've been interviewing small bankers, many of whom, Heidi, will not give their last names and don't want to go on air because they're afraid of their regulators. And what they've told us again and again is the small community bank is getting killed. It can't afford the compliance costs. And because it's getting killed, the very people who are best at loaning money to small businesses, the very people who might get their first Camp Bow Wow franchise, are also being hurt. Talk about how access to credit has really been affected by Dodd-Frank and on small business owners in particular, Heidi.
Well, we've seen since Dodd-Frank came into play, it's just incredibly difficult for our franchisees to get financing now. And before, it wasn't easy, but it was, you know, a lot more feasible. And it's very, very discouraging because there are so many passionate people that just need a little help, a little push financially, and they can make it happen and build an incredible business off of one of our franchises and, you know, take care of a lot of doggies and a lot of employees, create a lot of jobs. And so it's so disheartening that they're trying so hard to protect people, but people don't want to be protected. They're willing to take risks in order to create jobs and to create wealth for their family. And if the good old government would get out of the way, we would have a lot more of that going on.
Yeah, it's so true. Let's talk about some of the things we ask all of our guests. A teacher that stands out in your mind, Heidi.
Oh, goodness. There were so many. But I think a professor at college, Professor Limberopoulos, he was a finance teacher. And I've never been a big numbers person. I mean, I can certainly read financial reports and get by. But he helped me kind of fall in love with the numbers and understand how important data analysis was to running a business or doing anything in life. And I think that's become a big part of who I am, which is counterintuitive to how I thought my marketing branding brain was going to work. But it's all about metrics now and data and making decisions around data.
Tell us about a hobby or a passion or a quirk of Heidi Gonzalez that no one would typically associate with you.
Yeah, that's a good one. Let's see. Gosh, that's hard. I grew up loving soccer and playing soccer, and that's how I got my scholarship to SMU was our family brought AYSO to Colorado, so the first soccer team when we were kids, and built it into a big program here.
That's great. Mentor, a particular mentor in your life who's meant the world to you.
Well, I have to say I've gotten to know Carly Fiorina pretty well, and I worked on her campaign as the lead in Colorado, and she is just an incredible person and just inspired me to be able to do whatever I wanted to do, like my parents did a long time ago, but in a different context. I think she's fantastic.
You know, Heidi, I saw her give a talk at a private function. It wasn't a deep political talk. It was much more about family and marriage in particular. She was talking about the importance of marriage to a group of mostly Christian folks, but people who are really concerned about marriage. And I was listening to her talk about being a secretary at HP and who came up beside her and who helped her and how she remembered those people and then all the people who were always rooting against her. And I was watching particularly the waiting staff. I always like watching, you know, ordinary folks, not the executives who are listening to her story, but ordinary folks, kids, you know, young people in their 20s, bartending and putting themselves through night school. And they were riveted, Heidi, riveted by her story. And they were African Americans, they were Hispanic, and it was just beautiful watching her story inspire, truly inspire that staff.
That's how she is. When you're around her, you feel inspired and you feel like you've got so much potential inside and she just wants to take a key and unlock it. And that's, I think, what her passion was about running for office and trying to kind of get back America back to that.
Your favorite breed of dog?
Labrador Retriever, who's sitting at my feet right now.
There you go. And cat, your favorite cat?
I love Siamese cats. I grew up on That Darn Cat, that movie. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yeah. Who are easier to deal with as customers, cat people or dog people?
Oh, Lordy, that's a tough one. I'm going to have to say cat people because they're a little bit more particular. Not that dog folks aren't, but when it comes to the specific care of their animals, I think.
The Stones or the Beatles?
The Beatles.
There you go. And last but not least, Heidi, the worst date you ever had?
Oh, my goodness. Probably it would have to go to a guy that I really liked, and we went out on a couple dates, and I found out he did not like dogs, and that was the end.
Oh, that's the end. That's the end. Oops. And it's good to not tell him ahead of time that you love dogs, too, because it's always good to find out the truth, because you know on dates, people will say anything to keep the date going. So that's
good. Boy, that's the truth.
That's the truth. Well, Heidi, thanks so much for taking the time with us. Thanks for sharing your story and even some of these quirky things as well. It was great having you on the show, and we look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thanks, Lee. Have a great day.
You bet. Thank you, Heidi. And this is Our American Stories. More after these messages. This is Lee Habib, and this is Our American Stories. If you're looking for news, well, you got the wrong station. And if you're looking for hot talk or some screaming and yelling, wrong again. We do stories and only stories here, stuff you can use, stuff you care about, the arts, entertainment, health, the law, and housing. The stuff that affects your lives and organized in that way. And we love to highlight the topics that get left by the wayside when so much of our media treats politics as the first and only concern of most Americans. And again, one of the most important topics in our lives is housing. How accessible it is, how affordable it is, how stable it is. Today we're joined by Cassandra Bajak and Austin Berg to take a deeper and an all too personal look at how property taxes are pressuring Americans to leave their homes. I know this. I wrote a piece in the National Review about how my own dad, who had paid $32,000 for a home in 1961, could have never imagined that his property tax bill would be $15,000 for 1 year. And that was 40 years later. And Cassandra is a homeowner from a suburb of Chicago. Austin is from the Illinois Policy Institute, the state's premier think tank. Cassandra and Austin, thanks for being here.
Thank you. Happy to.
You bet. Let's start with you, Cassandra. Let's start with just your story. And Austin, you'll come in on the policy level in a bit, if you don't mind. You and your family, Cassandra, live in Crystal Lake, Illinois, where the slogan is, a good place to live. Set the scene for us, if you could.
Well, it is a great place to live. And when my husband and I decided to move here from Elgin 13 years ago, we did look for a better community, better schools, good neighborhood and nice little downtown area. And we built our house 13 years ago. Unfortunately, we didn't expect our taxes to double. We knew there would be an increase because of the better amenities and, you know, local city and, you know, suburb schools and everything like that. We love that. But unfortunately, our taxes have doubled and are pretty prohibitive at this point.
And your husband was an Army vet. You have two kids. And you work in, of all things, the mortgage industry. But what you discovered is, well, at a certain point in time, from the day you became a homeowner to today, the property tax bill ultimately started to catch up with the mortgage bill. Talk about that.
Well, it not only caught up, it exceeded it. And we're seeing that happen all over Cook County, McHenry County, Lake County, everywhere in the suburbs of Chicago, including the city. But usually the tax base when we do new construction or, you know, evaluate taxes is about 2%. We're well above that, and Austin can give you the details on that, but we're at least double that factor since the values haven't really changed. The taxes have doubled, and we're trying to figure out what's increased, what's gotten better for us. And it's status quo, basically, but it just hasn't, we haven't seen a phenomenal improvement or anything from what we came here from 13 years ago.
You bet. And Austin, you know, just about my dad, he bought the house in 1961, and his personal property taxes at the time were a little over $200. And that skyrocketed to almost $15,000, and he had paid the house off decades before. And so here's a case where the property taxes were many, many times fold over his highest mortgage payment. Where does this money go, Austin? What's happening with property taxes? Give us a look from the top and the policy level in Illinois, but this is New Jersey. This is a lot of states, isn't it, Austin?
Yeah, that's the sad part about stories like Cassandra's, is that they're increasingly becoming the norm in Illinois. So Illinois is one of the highest property taxing states in the country, and we come in about number two or number three every year. And after Chicago phases in its record-setting property tax increase over the next couple of years, we're the odds-on favorite to take the top spot. So what does that mean in practice? Well, the average property tax bill, take McHenry County, where Cassandra lives, that comes out to $800 a month, average. So can you imagine just being, you know, a real estate agent in a middle-class area trying to sell that tax liability to new people coming into your neighborhood? I mean, these are good schools. They're pretty good schools. But you could pay for a top-tier private school pretty much anywhere else in the country with the type of money people are spending here on property taxes.
Yep.
So this is why you're seeing, you know, record-breaking out-migration from Illinois over the past few years, because who would want to stick around and pay that bill? It's just fundamentally unfair.
Yep. And Austin, do people ask the question now? I would think that they're getting increasingly wise. They must want to ask the question, where were taxes 4 years ago? Where are they now? Because then they can actually do a little graph. 800 today, maybe 1600 8 years from now. And by the way, when I retire and I've paid this thing off, wow, keep putting that line up, and maybe I've just paid off a home I can't afford anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you're basically paying a mortgage you can never pay off, and you're renting your home from the government, and the government is not a very good landlord. So you see, since 1990, you see in Illinois, you see property tax revenues have gone up 3.5 times the median household income. So people are just getting squeezed left and right, 3.5 times the median household income. Incomes have been stagnant, housing values have been stagnant or declined, and property taxes get higher and higher and higher every year.
Amazing. Cassandra, now we've heard your dilemma. What are you doing? I mean, are you considering a move? What are you going to do?
Well, we really have to, unfortunately. Now, my children were born and raised in this house. We wanted to stay in Crystal Lake forever. You know, it's a good location for our jobs and everything like that. And we've appealed several times and to really no good result as far as that's concerned. They ended up changing the factors on us where our property value now seems accurate, but the factors have gone up. So we're stuck between a rock and a hard place. So downsizing either here in Illinois to keep our children in school with their friends or moving out of state, which is a very possible option for us as well. We're really in a crunch right now. We're trying to decide that for our family.
Well, and it's interesting, and Austin, I'm wondering if you could weigh in here. One of the things we love to cover here on this show is where are people moving from and where are they moving to? And we just follow the annual Atlas Van Line Survey, which I think is the most fascinating policy look at this space than anything, almost any think tank could provide, because, well, generally, many folks might not care about, you know, public policy the way we put it out at think tanks. But man, Atlas Van Lines doesn't have a dog in the fight. It's just sort of an interesting tidbit. Talk about where people are moving from and to and why.
Sure. So you can look at moving company studies. You can look at IRS data. You can look at census data. All of those studies point to Illinois residents leaving for Texas, leaving for Florida, leaving for Arizona, leaving for Indiana, just lower tax states where you can get a lot more house for your money. And when you look at the survey data, the two number one reasons for moving, long distance moves, this is according to census data, this is common sense stuff, but it's economic reasons, so jobs, and number two is housing. So if you're in a state like Illinois where the jobs climate is among the worst in the nation, the taxes, the property taxes are among the highest in the nation, wages are stagnant, why wouldn't you move to a booming state where taxes are reasonable, you're not seeing out of control pension and health care costs for government workers, you're not seeing crazy workers' compensation costs that are hitting cash-strapped local governments.
Yep.
You're not seeing these crazy prevailing wage requirements you see in Illinois. It's a no-brainer for a lot of families.
You know, in Austin, what we're not considering, we did a segment on the Mercedes-Benz corporate offices in Montvale, New Jersey, moving to Sandy Springs, Georgia. And they said one of the big reasons was that the costs of housing were absorbed by them in payroll. So the businesses have to pay the cost if they want to keep their people put. And then they got to pass those costs along to somebody else. Talk about the impact of these higher taxes on businesses themselves, Austin.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been doing a lot of work on manufacturing across the state. And when you talk to manufacturers, I just talked to one in South Cook County, and he's moving his 500 jobs. It's called Hoist Lift Truck. They make forklifts. They'll be moving their business, which gives about 500 jobs, great, I think, average salary in the $60,000, $70,000 range, moving them just a matter of miles to Indiana. And when I was talking to their CEO, Marty Flaska, he was saying, I thought this would be a tough sell to my employees, but when I tell them what they're going to pay for housing versus what they're paying in Cook County, when I tell them what they're going to pay in, say, sales tax just for stuff, for diapers, for food, for anything, for any type of service or good, they're going to get it cheaper. Their quality of life is going to skyrocket. My bottom line will be benefited by getting out of this tax structure. It's a win-win for everybody.
Well, it is. And what I'd love to do is follow up with you, Cassandra. If you do move, I want to find out where you've moved to. I want to find out what your life's like. We want to do one of those WPA-like long-form stories where we follow people around from where they've moved from and to, and let the American public know this is going on not just in your life, because I know so many people are feeling this. It's happening in Cassandra's life, and guys like Austin Berg at the Illinois Policy Institute, well, they're keeping track of it all. Thanks so much for both of you joining us today.
Thanks, Lee.
You bet. This is Lee Habib. This is Our American Stories, and these are the kind of stories I know you care about. And by the way, folks, if your property taxes aren't out of control, get to those school board meetings. Petition your state legislature. When they say it's only a 1% or a 2% increase, say no. Say no, because 2% every year times 20 years, and the next thing you know, your state's Illinois, too. This is Lee Habib. Again, this is Our American Stories. You can catch all of our material at OurAmericanNetwork.org.